funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does a career in the arts contribute to an actor's experience of his own life and of the truths of life in general? Academy Award winner Alan Arkin was 5 years old when he announced to his father that he would be an actor when he grew up, and his focus on that career path never wavered. He is best known to American audiences for his roles in dozens of movies and television shows that followed a successful stage career, but his work in performing and teaching improvisation, he was one of the first veterans of Chicago's famed Second City Troupe, has grounded his understanding of himself both as an artist and as a person. The new memoir by actor, writer, and director Alan Arkin is called An Improvised Life. Alan, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
What's fascinating about this early declaration that you would be an actor someday is that it seems like for you it was never about being a star, which is why some kids will say they want to be an actor. What was it about this idea of doing this thing that drew you?
I think it was multiple things, but also, I mean, who can remember what happens when they were five? I can give a kind of an approximation of it, but there are always factors in people's lives that are beyond their understanding. Partly it was the recognition that my father used to take me to movies, and he was more fascinated by what was going on in movies than anything else I ever saw in his life. So I said, maybe I can get as much attention from him if I start doing that. I think that was part of it. There's just a fascination about being other people, the way other people function, the way other people work, the way other people approached life, the way they thought, the way they moved. It was fascinating for me from the beginning.
And from the beginning, you write about this, you weren't just admiring actors, but you had a really keen eye for sort of figuring out whether a performance worked or not and why it worked.
Yeah, well, it was my own version of that. Everybody's got their own skew on that. Yeah, mine was whether it rang true for me or not. But different things ring true for different people at different times. I don't mean to sound vague, but I don't want to be doctrinaire about it either.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting, too, to think about this, that, that ability to recognize what works in other people's performances, eventually you have to turn that on yourself, and that sort of self...
That's harder.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot harder. I think one of the things that I was good at was that I had a kind of instinct. I'd go watch how teachers work. I'd look at teachers at acting schools. I'd audit. And I would want to see if the people actually improved under the teachers. If the teacher was just doing something that was self-aggrandizing, or whether the work in front of me actually improved. And when once I felt that I could see that somebody's work was actually getting better, I said, well, I got to put myself in this person's hands. Hmm. And I was very, very good at taking criticism. I took criticism very, very much to heart, and I let it affect me. And I think that was one of the things that allowed me to have a certain degree of success.
Is there an art to giving criticism that people will take to heart, or is it about really the individual being open to that?
No. I think there's very, very much an art. A lot of times I'll see criticism being given, and it'll be because the director or the teacher feels that he's being betrayed by the student or the actor in not having his words listened to. I don't know very many actors who are capable of that. I mean, that takes a kind of a massive ego. I think most to all of us in the profession are constantly at a loss as to what we're doing. I mean, we need some kind of outside. It's one of the few arts which is so totally internalized that we very rarely know exactly what we're doing. So, like a benign, helpful criticism is always. I've hardly ever known an occasion where that wasn't really valued. It's crucial, I think, for the director or the teacher to put themselves the same side, that you both want the same thing, that he's not some authority on a throne that's 20 feet high that's laying down the law, but just that you're both trying to accomplish the same thing, and that makes life infinitely easier.
Are the best directors really very good teachers?
Yeah, I think so. The more subtle they are about it, the better.
You didn't initially take Paul Sills up on his offer to join Second City. Can you talk about the concerns you had about leaving New York and going to Chicago?
Yeah, well, I had envisioned a serious career in the theater with some longevity and some continuity. And Paul Sills offered me a job at a hole-in-the-wall theater in Chicago. I thought that would be the end of everything, that I'd never escape from there, that I'd be working for $100 a week in a hole in the wall. And I didn't want that. It didn't feel very grand to me or very secure. So I thanked him and went about my business, and then starved in New York for another year. And then finally, with my hat in my hand, I called him back and asked him if the job was still open, and he said, yeah, and I breathed a sigh of relief on the one hand, and the other, I said, well, there goes my career out the window. And I went to Chicago to this little hole-in-the-wall theater, and I lived in a 10-by-10 room with a bathroom down the hall. And it was the happiest I'd ever been, because I was finally working at my profession for the first time in my life. And 6 months later, we started getting national attention, and I was, instead of it being the end of everything, it was the beginning of everything.
And this was 1960. You know, it's interesting to think back. Audiences today are familiar with improv. They sort of understand the concept when they walk in for a performance. Was that the case back then?
Well, it was with our audience. We have a very, very a pristine audience. Most of our audience was from the University of Chicago. It was a very hip, very aware audience. They knew jazz, and they knew what we were trying to do. It was very partisan. I guess partisan is the word I'm looking for. And it was extraordinary in that they came knowing that a lot of what we would see every night would be failure, because no series of improvs can work just consistently all the time. Some of what we did was wonderful. Some of it was mediocre, and some was terrible. But the audience came knowing that that's what it was going to be like, and it was extraordinary liberating. It allowed us to be in a place where we could fail, and failure is an important thing to understand and to be part of. Yeah, a lot of people recognize that from your successes, you don't really learn a lot. You may learn something about character, but you're not going to learn anything about the profession from your successes. From your failures, you get a very clear sense of where not to go, what not to do.
And I guess you also learn to shake it off very quickly, because you've got another scene to do where you've got to figure out the
exactly.
Next thing to say.
Yeah, sometimes you're playing 15, 20 characters a night. It was very different. It was very different. If I look at the videos of what we were doing then, it's a very different kind of form than what I see now. It's what I see now from almost every group is a kind of MTV, hurry up and let's get it over with, soundbite kind of thing. And we were doing scenes that were sometimes 10, 15 minutes long. We didn't care. We would do pantomimes, we would do operas, we would do all kinds of things, dance, whatever were songs. Whatever worked, whatever scene needed, we would do. And if it worked, it would become part of a repertoire of things, and we put in a more formal part of the evening. It was extraordinary. I was there for 2 years, and it was like 20 years of training. Mm. It was just amazing.
The thing that really fascinates me about the art of improv is the yes and concept, where if someone's already started something, if you're going to jump in, you're there to back up what's already taking place, as opposed to come in and sort of shift things to whatever you want to do.
Well, I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, if That's a school of thought that I don't totally adhere to. I think I think it's a nice conceit, and I think it's very good. A lot of times, you don't want to come in and destroy somebody's reality. That's you don't want to come in if somebody's opened a fake window on the set. You don't want to come in and say there's no window there and get a cheap laugh from the audience. But by the same token, if improvisation in theater is a reflection of life, people don't always do that in life. People are sometimes contrary and negative with somebody else in life. If you do that too much, it becomes boring and it becomes fake drama. But I remember when it came out of. It came out of a time when Paul Sills was seeing so much negativity in what we were doing that he decided for a period of time he didn't want anybody to be negative at all anymore. And he adopted this technique of yes and it was wonderful. It added an enormously potent color to what we were doing. But to have people doing that all the time is not a reflection of what life is all about. I mean, to me, it's a similar kind of thing as saying there shouldn't be any violence in movies, that there's too much violence. Yeah, I think there is too much violence, but it's also a question of how the violence is portrayed. I mean, there's plenty of violence in Shakespeare's plays, but you feel like it's in service to the entity, that he's not reveling and loving the violence. It's just part of the human condition, and to avoid talking about it or showing it is an evasion.
So where does trust play into all that?
Where does trust?
Yeah. You have to trust the other actors that you're on stage with.
Yeah, very much so. Well, I think you have to do that no matter what the venue. Particularly so in improvisation, because you have no net. There's no safety net except the other actors. You don't have a script to fall back on. You don't need any specific lighting. You don't have the music unless the piano player isn't completely in tune with the theme of what he picks up on and what he sees in front of you. Yeah, in the first group I had, we were eight people, and it was just incredibly trusting. In improv, you got to trust the people you're with. That's all there is. There's no script, no director while you're working. It's crucial.
So when you left Second City, you went and worked on Broadway and discovered that you didn't like it as much as you would go on to like working on camera.
Yeah. Well, the repetition made me crazy. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stand it. I didn't see anything creative about doing the same thing over and over and over again for a year, 300 times. Made me crazy.
Because you're sort of locked in on opening night. If the show's set.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what you do for the next year.
It's so interesting, though, because if you think about, you make a movie and you do it maybe a few times and then the scene is set and then it lasts forever.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole idea for me is to play with it until you reach some kind of state where it's the way you want it, the way the director's happy with it, yeah, and then you're on to the next problem. It's much more interesting to me.
My guest this hour is actor, writer, and director Alan Arkin. His new memoir is called An Improvised Life.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Where the hell's my parachute?
Okay, all right. Which one of you bastards stole my parachute? This is the Bombardier here. We gotta turn back. Haley, we gotta turn back now. Haley, you hear me up there? We gotta turn back. Okay, we're gonna turn back now. Haley, let's turn back. We're gonna turn back.
What is it this time, Yosarian?
Tom Bastard stole my chute.
Anything the matter?
My parachute.
What about it?
It's gone.
Don't worry about it.
What do you mean, don't worry about it? What am I supposed to do if I have to bail out? Use my handkerchief.
That's the kind of humor in the face of adversity that keeps America strong. I like you, Yosarian.
Listen, Edvark, I'd like to kill you, but I haven't got time right now.
You can have my chute.
Huh?
And I gave it to Milo.
You gave it to Milo?
He's got all the chutes. He's got a hell of a deal going for silk in Alexandria.
Maybe I do.
Looks like they've seen us coming.
They've seen us. Oh, God. They've seen us.
Better get ready to dump those eggs.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard a clip of my guest this hour, Alan Arkin, in the 1970 film Catch-22 that was Charles Grodin that you heard with him. Welcome back, Alan. I'm wondering, on any film, this one in particular, what does it take to sort of live in that moment and not be thinking about what's going to come later for your character and really sort of, do you have to actually feel it as the character feels it?
Oh, God, that's your life's work? yeah, well, pretty much. If you're really doing the work as I think you should do it, there's a part of the emotional life that's you're going to be absolutely living in. Yeah, that's certainly what I, for many, many years, tried to do. I can't do it so much anymore, but that's for decades and decades. That's what you try to do. You try to live inside the character and find out exactly what it feels like at that moment and in that event.
You can't do it so much anymore. Why is that?
I feel like I've done that, been there. Mm-hmm. It's more exhausting than I want or I'm capable of dealing with. I'm an old man now, Chris, and I want to have a good time, and I feel like now I can, for most of what the characters I play are feeling, I can do a semblance of it and have a memory of what it was like that's so vivid that I don't have to worry about nagging myself and trying to dredge it up. I couldn't do that for a long time. For a long time, I had to really spend a lot of time and effort in trying to access what those feelings were. But it's just gotten easier. It's not the torture. A part of why I get so intellectual about it, or got so intellectual about it, was because it was painful for me. Acting was very hard for me. It didn't come easily, so I had to think about it and try to find out, figure out ways of making it easier. So too much time went into thinking. I can work with an 8-year-old girl now, who's got as much technique as I do, and I don't know where the hell it comes from. I don't know where they got it or how they do it, but I'm very envious because there was never that case for me. But it seems to be easier for a lot of people than it was for me.
Does it bother you that people who've never tried acting assume that an actor's life is really easy?
Does it bother me?
Yeah.
Only when I'm accosted with it. I don't care what people think if I'm not accosted by somebody.
You know what I mean, though. Actors make it look simple to do what you do.
Yeah, and they think every actor, if they've seen you in a movie that you're worth $50 million, there's an expectation of kind of not only simple, but that you have an easy life and that nothing can ever touch you. It's strange.
Go ahead.
I'm thinking about going into something else.
A second career?
No, it's a little late.
Teaching is a big part of your life and has been for a long time now.
I'm sorry, was it eating?
Teaching. Well, I'm sure eating's part of your life. But
eating is a very, very good big part of my life.
No, but I'm interested in teaching because you don't just do workshops with people who are highly trained and have this as a professional goal. You also work with regular people, and I'm curious about how the dynamic is different.
Oh, there's, well, I'm a great believer. I don't know how much you read.
I read the whole book.
I talk a lot about Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is an extraordinary book, but if you examine the title, it tells you a lot of what you need to know. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind means approaching every event as if you've never experienced it before, if you've never seen it before. And it gives you an enormously broader view than what you get if you think of yourself or allow yourself to think of yourself as an expert, which starts shutting down doors, shutting down possibilities. And what I see with a lot of actors that come in is they have a preconceived idea of, they'll have a technique, and that'll make some of it easier. But a lot of times they'll have preconceived ideas of what improv is, that it means a certain kind of comedy, and you want to get a certain kind of laugh, and you want to get a certain kind of attention. The people who have not had experience with acting are sometimes infinitely more open as to what the possibilities are. Like, we just did a workshop for 20 lawyers. I had a lawyer that did a workshop about... It sounds like I'm selling the workshop, but I'm not. I can't do them very often, first of all, because my other work, and second of all, because they're exhausting. Mm-hmm. But they're just very, very exciting. A guy took a workshop with us about 3 years ago. He was a big trial lawyer, and he was so excited about it. He wanted to get a lot of trial lawyers to come here and do a workshop. And I had a lot of trepidation about it because I thought they were going to be smart-ass and smug and superior. They were one of the most inventive, open groups that we've ever worked with. My wife and I worked together on the workshop. They absolutely blew us away. I saw work from them, from these trial lawyers, that I hardly ever see with the actors. Scenes came out of it that I'll remember for the rest of my life. Hmm. It's because they don't have a specific agenda of what they feel like they want to get out of a workshop. They want to open. The lawyers were like that. I'll get teachers that come in the field the same way. They just want to open up. They feel in some way they've been blocked, and they want to remember how to play. So I'm very, very, I'm much more excited about having a mix of people than I am just people that call themselves actors. You know, plus I can do a movie, and this happens all the time. I'll be in a movie and I'll work with somebody like, I mentioned an 8-year-old girl, that's Abigail Breslin, mm-hmm. who was my granddaughter in Little Miss Sunshine. And I can be working with her on one hand, I'll be working with somebody who's been a professional actor for 50 years, on the other hand, and time and time again, I'll see the amateurs just wipe the floor with the so-called professionals. So you never, and then you see somebody who's done something over and over and over again and been very, very good, and all of a sudden it doesn't work anymore. All of a sudden, either they're tired or they don't understand the part. You never know when a spark is going to fly, when somebody's going to come to life. And you never know who's going to come from, an amateur, a professional. I worked 2 years with Sidney Lumet, which was one of the great joys of my life. And we just lost him a couple of months ago, which is a great loss to the film community. And I would see him take people. We'd do a rehearsal of a scene, and I'd look at somebody doing the scene. I'd say, God, they're terrible. This terrible performance. Sidney doesn't say a lot to people. I said, if I was directing this person, it would take me 10 minutes to get a semblance of a performance out of this person. Sidney could say one thing to that person, one sentence, and the whole performance would turn upside down, inside out. So you never know. You never know how you're going to be able to reach somebody or what's going to be able to get to them.
You mentioned a minute ago that you've worked with people who wanted to remember how to play. And it's funny because I watch my kids and they're still young enough that they'll sort of role play and they have no particular aim. Why do we stop doing that as we get older?
Because my strong feeling is that kids, I talk about that in the book, that we watch kittens and and puppies doing what we call play, and it looks very cute and very endearing, and we laugh when they fall off things and shake sticks. What the puppies and kittens are doing is they're learning the crucial behavior that's going to keep them alive when they get older. They're learning how to defend themselves. They're learning how to kill animals. That's what the shaking of the stick is. My strong belief is that children do the same thing. We watch them play, and they're learning crucial tools for what they need to be and do when they grow up. And a lot of what they learn is from what they see in movies, on television, and a lot of what they learn is from watching their parents. And a lot of times, I think that kids give themselves the wrong messages. And I think that these are the kids that very often come to the workshops. They recognize, almost invariably, it's subconscious, but there's the recognition that something about the play didn't work right, so they're stuck. They're stunted in some way in their development, and they want to use the workshop as a way to get themselves unstuck. In the same way, in a similar way as to when dyslexic kids are worked with, there's some modes of therapy that include relearning how to crawl. They find that a lot of dyslexic kids crawl, instead of cross arm and leg crawling, they cross with the left arm and leg doing one step, and then the right arm and leg doing the next step, and they have to relearn how to crawl. Well, to me, what I see in the workshops is a lot of times people relearning how to crawl, relearning how to play themselves into a slightly different identity than they have inflicted on themselves.
And you write that self-discovery is not necessarily, certainly not easy, and it's not necessarily fun.
Yeah, it's exactly true. There's an aphorism that I've been meditating for like 40 years, and it's become a core of my entire existence. And there's an aphorism I keep around with me that on my cell phone that I look at all the time. It's from a Tibetan Rinpoche that says it's not a good thing to advertise. It's not a good thing to advertise meditation because it's not all fun and games. It's about self-discovery, and a lot of what you find out is not necessarily the happiest things to find out. A lot of self-criticism goes into a real and significant and deep practice. But it's like that with anything. It's without intense and loving self-criticism, you don't get very far in any arena. I don't think if you're just filled with self-congratulation, you're not going to grow.
It was years after you were at Second City and found that the best characters you did were sort of misfits and people who didn't quite fit into what everyone else expected, that I guess through therapy you thought, oh my gosh, that is one thing they all had in common, and that must have had something to do with who you felt you were at the time.
Yeah, exactly. I thought I was playing a million different kinds of characters. I prided myself on being the character actor at Second City. I'd gone a lot of different directions, and a part of it was in order to hide from myself my identity, who I was. And I thought I was very cocky about it. And then years later, when I started examining myself and my work, I realized that they all had different externals, but they were all similar in that they were somewhat inarticulate and misfits in their environment. And I realized that must be the way I thought of myself.
Does being comfortable in your own skin make you maybe better as an actor, but also make acting less necessary?
The second half is absolutely true. The first half, it makes you wiser, but it doesn't necessarily make you more riveting.
Mm-hmm.
The intense laser beam of intensity that you see, of drive that Pacino comes out of a life and death need to be doing what they're doing, and it's riveting to watch. But I think it ultimately kills other aspects of the person. And I'm a lot happier. I'm infinitely happier now than I was 20, 30 years ago, and if it means that my work is not as interesting, well, so be it. But I think it is interesting, but in a different way. It has there's a kind of power in people that don't care that is riveting. And when I say I don't care, I don't mean that from a negative standpoint. I mean from a place that their life is not at stake in what the activity. They may be taking it seriously. They may be taking the activity seriously. They may be doing it to the best of their ability, but they know that life is something more than that and broader than that. There's a kind of extraordinary power that comes with that, and I think it's intimidating to other people because you don't know where it's coming from. You don't know where that power is coming from or what it represents. But how did I get off on this?
We're going to take a quick break and then we will we'll go in a slightly different direction, but I think it's fascinating. Alan Arkin is my guest. He's an actor, writer, and director, and author of the new memoir, An Improvised Life.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Grandpa?
Yeah.
I'm kind of scared about tomorrow.
Are you kidding me? You're going to blow them out of the water. They're not going to know what hit them.
Grandpa?
Yeah.
Am I pretty?
Olive? You are the most beautiful girl in the whole world.
You're just saying that?
No, I'm not. I'm madly in love with you. And it's not because of your brains or your personality. It's because you're beautiful. Inside and out.
Grandpa?
What?
I don't want to be a loser.
You're not a loser. Where'd you get the idea you're a loser?
Because Dad hates losers.
Whoa. Back up a minute. You know what a loser is? A real loser is somebody that's so afraid of not winning, they don't even try. Now, you're trying, right? Well, then you're not a loser. We're going to have fun tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
We can tell them all to go to hell. Good night, sweetie. I love you.
That was Alan Arkin and Abigail Breslin in the 2006 film Little Miss Sunshine, which earned Arkin an Academy Award. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. Alan, when you got that script, did you think to yourself, okay, here's my Oscar?
No, I've never thought that in my life. No, I just thought I had to do it. I thought it was one of the best scripts I'd read in years and years, and I just knew I had to do it. I was just nuts about that script. I thought it was incredibly subtle and rich and funny and crazy. Great character.
Did you know at every moment when you were working on the film where you were and where your character was? Were there times where you thought, I'm kind of lost here, or did it always make perfect sense from the beginning?
Well, it always made absolute sense to me. I understood the writer's sensibility. I mean, I felt like I every once in a while you read something and you say, yeah, I wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
I felt in a way like I had written it. It just it just was a complete symbiotic event all the way through. And I think everybody connected with it felt that same way. It was a wonderfully cohesive group of people, the directors and the writer and the actors, and it was a very, very happy set. It wasn't a buoyant set, because we all felt we were walking a tightrope. Everybody felt that there was a very, very delicate dance that had to be done here, that we all knew was incredibly funny, but it was also taken very seriously at the same time. There's no pandering to eye rolling or anything like that. So we were all doing a tightrope walk, but it paid off. I'm enormously pleased with what happened in the visit, and Greg Kinnear and I has become friends. Abigail Breslin and I are still friends. It was very, very, very close, wonderful experience.
Do you think it was your best performance?
I don't know how you say things like that. Not you. I mean, I don't know what's. I think it's as good as anything I've ever done. Maybe I'm a little bit lenient on myself, but there's been, I guess, about 8, 9, 10 times I think I've been pretty good.
Well, no, I think that's entirely true. I mean, it does seem like it would be hard to sort of judge one very different script up against another one.
Yeah, it's not possible.
Yeah.
One character may be tailor-made for you, and you breeze through it so it doesn't feel like it has as much value as something you had to work your butt off in order to attain. But who knows? It depends on what you felt like you achieved from each script, and how hard or easy it was to get there. And then you have the whole thing of different people having different feelings about what their needs are. You know, different people. When somebody's watching something, everybody's got their own needs about what constitutes, in quotes, good, and what constitutes not good.
Coming from improv and learning to embrace this idea that it was okay to experiment and to fail, I mean, you don't really have that on camera, do you? I mean, I suppose you can do several versions and the director chooses the one that seems to work best, but there's no option to fail when you're making a film.
There are no options to fail?
Well, I mean, you don't want to.
No, there are plenty of options. If I'm close with the director, I can always say, and have done on a lot of occasions, I don't improvise on camera unless I'm really, really comfortable with the director, because mm-hmm. I don't like letting the entire performance go and be in somebody else's hands. But by the same token, if I'm really comfortable with the director, I'll say, I want to try something here. I'll ask him and I'll ask the other people in the scene. But I'll only do things like that if I'm really comfortable with people. If I had a good working relationship with people. I would never spring something on other actors who are tentative about improvisation or tentative about me or their part or something. I just feel like that would be unfair.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Tim in Arlington. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thank you very much. I wonder if I could go back in time a little bit. I first introduced myself to Mr. Arkin's work in a very favorite novel brought to screen called The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by the author Carson McCullers, where he plays John Singer, the deaf-mute who does not speak for the whole duration of the film except for some very well-placed utterances at a very emotional moment in the film. And I just wondered if he could address the role the improvisation played in that role and maybe a comment or two about Ms. McCullers' work.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was one of my favorite films to be connected with. It was a great, great experience and an honor to be connected with it. And there was very, very little improvisation that went into that. I had learned sign language. It took me months to get fluid enough with it to do even the things I did in the film. And I had to stick very, very close to what my teachers had taught me. I didn't know enough of sign language to work around what I was saying in the film. The only little bit of improvisation I did was there's a scene where I'm walking down the street, a kind of a lonely walk down the street. I'm all by myself. And I just said to the director, I said, I want to be talking to myself in this scene. And he said, fine. He said, good idea. And so I decided what I wanted to be saying to myself. And I did that. That was really the only improvisation I remember in the whole thing.
Are you always collecting characters?
No, not anymore. I'm collecting me now. Figure out who I am. If the characters are in there, fine. If not, that's fine too. I've kind of let that go. I used to do that. I don't anymore.
So it took you, it sounds like, decades of working really hard, both professionally and personally, to sort of come to be fully at peace with who you were. Was there part of you when your sons became actors that thought, oh, no, what are they in for?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I had my heart in my mouth. I still do. Adam's in a pretty secure place right now. This past few months, for the first time in a long time, I feel like I can relax a little bit with all three of them. Adam's is not only a wonderful actor, but he's become a very, very highly sought-after television director, and a brilliant one, too. He somehow manages to have a fingerprint on stuff that that very often seems generic to me. So he's in pretty good shape. I breathe a sigh of relief with him. Matthew, on top of being a brilliant actor, is now teaching in Los Angeles and has got a following and loves teaching and is brilliant at it. And so he's got a safety net there for when he's not working. And my youngest son, Tony, who's a writer and a brilliant actor and writer and artist and everything, has kind of secured himself as an editor in New York now, and has got more work than he can handle. So a little bit of a sigh of relief finally. But they're all in the 40s and 50s now, so it's taken a long time to have that sigh of relief.
Your job is finally done?
I don't know if it's done, but it's okay for the moment.
Do you, I mean, obviously they must have learned a lot from you as an actor and as people in the industry themselves. Are there things that you've learned about yourself by watching them work?
No, I can't, if I have, I can't.
You don't see it necessarily?
I learned about myself. Well, it gives me a great sense of pride that they all work from what I consider to be the right place. I feel like all of their work is enormously authentic. They're constantly trying to explore and grow with it. Number one and number two, I've worked with all of them. I've directed all three of them, and all three of us have acted together. And in the many, many times that that's happened, there has never been one problem. We've never had any issue with each other whatsoever. I mean, there have been plenty of issues in life, as there kind of have to be with parents and children over the years, but there has never been one on stage or in front of the camera.
You,
so I feel really good about that, too.
You are also a musician, and you performed a lot early in your career. Does that play into the way you approach acting at all?
Well, I think one of my favorite things anybody said about my acting was Peter Bonners. Peter Bonners was also he was in Catch 22. He was talking about my work at one point. He says, I act like an actor. He says, you act like a musician. And I didn't know what he meant by it, and I didn't ask him, but it felt like a real compliment at the time.
Do you think in the ensemble sense, or?
I don't really know how he meant it, but I like musicians, so I held it as a compliment.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Carrie in Arlington. Hey, Carrie.
Hi. Hey, this is really great. You're one of my favorites, big fan. And my dad was a bombardier navigator. And
I'm sorry, say again?
My dad, excuse me, was a bombardier and navigator.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. And he said, you really nailed it.
Oh.
Absolutely nailed it. That was
Well, that's very kind. I don't know how I nailed it. I just sat in that little shell, and I felt scared and uncomfortable. So I guess that's what he meant.
How much, I mean, has the amount of rehearsal changed for a film? Is it usually just a couple of days before you start shooting things?
Yeah, it depends on the film. Little Miss Sunshine, we rehearsed for a week. When I did Glengarry Glen Ross, we rehearsed for a month. I've never experienced anything like that before. I need a lot of rehearsal. I love a lot of rehearsals, and I welcome them when anybody says we want to have a few days rehearsal. But most of the time, it doesn't happen. And I'm finding more and more that more and more movies are, you get the male lead and you get the female lead, and you get about 40 generic computer operators and people that are kind of generic. I remember in the films of Frank Capra and so many films of that period, you can come out of the theater and, yeah, there were the male lead and the female lead, but you remember 10, 15 other characters in the film. I don't find that happening so much anymore.
Do you think that's about writing scripts that are meant to feature stars as opposed to telling real stories?
I think it's less interest in people. I don't find that that events have more and more taken over what the films are about and not the people. I feel like that's why I do a lot of improvising these days, is because somebody will give me a script and I'll feel like the architecture is good, the draftsmanship of it, it makes sense, and the characters all have a purpose, but they have no real life to them. There's no language in it, so I'll tell the director, yeah, I'll play the character if I can play with the language. I said, I'm not going to do anything arbitrarily, and I won't do anything to affect other people's dialogue, but I want to be able to play with it and give this thing some kind of richness and texture. And people kind of expect that from me now, and most of the time they say, yeah.
The new memoir by actor, writer, and director Alan Arkin is called An Improvised Life. Alan, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. It was lovely talking to you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.